The title of this lecture is The Recipe Economy, and it introduces some ways of thinking about the economy, in particular the issues of economic growth and wealth and poverty. So one way to start out would be to ask a question that people often ask is, if we can put a man on the moon, why can't we cure poverty? And people ask that particularly when they become aware of the poverty that exists both in this country and in the world. We're reminded of the poverty that exists in this country by an event like the hurricane that we just witnessed that caused New Orleans to flood. And one thing that's striking is that the people there, many of the people there who lost everything from their point of view, from the point of view of an affluent person, didn't lose very much. And that's really sad to think about, is just how poor those people were. And how often it is, or how often it seems that these weather catastrophes seem to strike poor people the worst and hit them the hardest. And I think that a lot of us are insulated from knowing just how poor some of these people are, and how little they have, and how difficult life is, especially compared to how we live it. And that, I think, would go even more, be even more strongly held about third world countries where the poverty is even deeper, where people, in the worst cases, are living on the equivalent, will be the equivalent to us of $1 a day. The short answer to the question why we can put a man on the moon but can't cure poverty is that you can design a space vehicle, but you cannot design an economic system. And the economic system is a lot more complex, and we don't control all the factors that go into it. An economy is embedded in a cultural and political system, and all these systems co-evolve. You may be hearing in the news arguments about evolution versus intelligent design. Well, an economy is definitely something that is not subject to intelligent design. It is something that evolves. There's much more of an analogy with evolution. And so, one way to say that is that the analogy to curing poverty isn't putting a man on the moon. It's more like curing cancer, or do not, or design, or coming up with a new and better species of animal. So nature is able to come up with new species, although very slowly through the process of evolution. But we really can't do that, although we're maybe on the verge of being able to do that. And the economy is more like the system, our ecological system, or the biological system, in that we don't have the kind of control that we have over things that we can engineer and design and build out of simple materials. Another way of putting that is we don't know how to nation build because nations are not built. Nations grow and evolve over years and centuries, mixing various cultural practices, political practices, and economic practices. And the economy, again, is embedded in that process. So I'm going to describe a theory of wealth and poverty that does not work. I call it the bar mitzvah candy theory of wealth and poverty. At a bar mitzvah, a 12-year-old boy stands up at a religious service, recites a portion of the Bible, and when it's over, he gets congratulated, and usually people who are attending the service take pieces of candy and throw them at the boy. And then when all the candy lands in the general neighborhood of the boy, all the young children are allowed to run up and grab the candy. And so what I call the bar mitzvah candy theory of poverty is wealth and poverty is that people that the what explains how some people are rich and some people are poor, it's sort of like some kids grabbed a lot of the candy and there was not much left for others. So that's sometimes what people think of as what explains why some people are wealthy and some people are poor. That it turns out that's not a particularly helpful theory. It doesn't explain wealth and poverty. And the alternative that I'll propose is something I call the growth ethics theory of wealth and poverty, that wealth requires a work ethic, a public service ethic, and a learning ethic. If you look across countries and you look for the countries that are wealthy and the countries that are poor, you will see some reasonably wealthy countries that have no resources, that didn't get much of the candy as you would conventionally think of it, and some countries that are quite poor that have a lot of resources, that seem to get a lot of the candy, so to speak, but they're still quite poor. And the difference is, I think, in these three ethics, that if you have an economy where work is rewarded, where people understand that work is rewarded, and where people believe in work, that then wealth will tend to be created. If you have countries with a very extremely strong aristocratic tradition where it's considered low class to work, or where certain people are not supposed to work, or the best people are not supposed to work, then you have problems with the work ethic. And where you have problems with the work ethic, you don't generate much wealth. The public service ethic is that the people who work for the government believe that their job is to serve the people. The very opposite of that is when the people in charge of the government are just trying to steal as much for themselves as possible. And unfortunately, there have been many tyrants throughout history, and there are many tyrants today who operate that way. They, their immediate family, and their loyal supporters and their immediate clan get the benefits of the economy, and everyone else is basically working to support the tyrants and the people who surround the tyrants. So that's the opposite of a public service ethic. And one thing you'll find, even in countries that are not completely dysfunctional, you'll still find many countries where you have to bribe public officials to get things done. India is an example of that, where you have to do a lot of bribing of public service officials to get them to do what here we would think of as their job. So, if you wanted to start a business in this country, start a restaurant, you would never consider that you would have to bribe the local public officials to get your permits to start the restaurant. In many other countries, you would have to do that kind of bribing. So we take a public service ethic for granted here among our public servants, but it really is not something that can be taken for granted throughout the world. And even here, there are definitely cities where there's corruption and places where there's corruption. And Louisiana, for example, has historically been well over 100 years, a place where there was relatively more corruption than in other parts of the United States. The final thing is a learning ethic. People have to value learning, they have to value science, they have to be willing to try new things and not always resist new things just because they're new or because they threaten existing interests. And that kind of learning ethic is absolutely necessary for growth, or else new things will never be tried or will never be allowed to emerge. So those are the what I call the growth ethics, and I think the difference between a wealthy individual and a poor individual is often has to do with those ethics, or at least the ethics that surround them. So if somebody is surrounded by people who have a poor work ethic, a poor public service ethic and a poor learning ethic, it's very hard for that individual to prosper. And that's why some nations tend to be more prosperous than other nations, because if you have a larger set of people who have the work ethic, public service ethic, and learning ethic, then you're going to have more overall prosperity. Okay, the next topic I want to bring out is sort of a measure of economic progress, and I call it the bags of flour measure. In 1500, if you worked for 3 days and then cashed your paycheck, so to speak, went into the giant, so to speak, you could have taken your paycheck and traded it in for one bag of flour. That's about what you could have produced in 3 days. Today in the United States, if you were to work for 3 days, cash your paycheck, take it into the giant, you could walk out with 430 bags of flour. So you're 430 times as productive as the average person was in 1500. And that's just an amazing amount of progress. It's almost inconceivable. I don't think we can conceive of the poverty and squalor that existed historically, even as much as 200 years ago. The average person lived in a state that is in a condition that is much worse. I mean, not just much worse than the worst person living in New Orleans today, but almost as bad as the poorest people in the poorest parts of the world today. So the elimination of what we call extreme squalor and extreme poverty in the Western world is actually a very recent phenomenon in terms of time. Between the year zero and the year 1500, there was very little growth to speak of. That one bag of flour that you could produce in 3 days, that was about what people were able to produce at the time of Christ, and 1500 years later, that's about what they were able to produce. Standard of living historically was very low. You can see this graphically in the graph that I've put up here, which shows a very slow, gradual takeoff in economic growth that began around 1500. You can see it a modest increase to 1800, and then you see the exponential growth starting to kick in after 1800 and well into this century. And really, most of the growth that has occurred in all of human history took place in just the last 100 years. It's amazing how much differently we live than people did just 100 years ago. And I think people 100 years ago would have felt more kinship to life around 1500 than to today. Today would be so bizarre to them, it would be unrecognizable. They would have an easier time recognizing life several hundred years earlier. Okay, so let's now talk about the economic problem. One way to think of, the problem that economies are trying to solve. That's what we mean by the economic problem. How do we evaluate it? How well an economy is doing? An economy is doing well if it solves the economic problem. Well, the economic problem is to transform land, labor, and natural resources into goods and services that satisfy human wants. And here we get to the idea that I call the recipe economy. So we can think in terms of recipes. Imagine that the world consists of a food court. And behind the food court, there's a farm where plants and animals grow spontaneously in adequate but limited supplies. Just pretend that they're out there growing. That's our basic level of resources that's given. It's these plants and animals that are growing behind the food court. Coming into the food court each day are consumers who want meals. And also at different times of the day, some of these same consumers work in the food court earning income to pay for meals. So the whole economy consists of this food court. We have these plants and animals, which are our basic natural resources to work with, and all we need to satisfy our wants are our meals. If you think of what the food court economy was like when things were very undeveloped, hundreds and hundreds of years ago, think of it as having very few recipes. And these recipes required a lot of work to prepare. It was a lot of manual labor. The meals were monotonous, they were low in nutrition, and they were not very tasty. But over time, people discovered new recipes. And with these new recipes came variety, there came efficiency, meaning that they were able to prepare them faster, and more pleasure, that they were more tasty. And this process of discovering new recipes is the process of economic growth. And that's really where wealth comes from. It didn't just land at our feet like candy at a bar mitzvah. It was accumulated over time as people discovered more and more scientific discoveries, technology, the application of ideas. That is really what's created wealth in the world. It's these new recipes. So where does capital fit in? We said that the three resources that we talk about in the economy are land, labor, and capital. Well, capital is not a resource that's just sitting out there to be used, or just sitting out there whenever we need it. Capital is something we have to build. Capital is the equipment that we use that's durable, long-term equipment that we use to help produce things. So in a movie theater, the capital is the projection equipment and the seats and so on. In a steel mill, the capital consists of the building, the factory building, the blast furnaces, and other heavy equipment that's used to help make the steel. So capital is part of the recipe. That is part of one of the things that makes our economy quite a bit more complicated than a simple food court, is that a lot of production goes into building capital. Building equipment that is used to produce other equipment and other goods and services, and that's called capital. So that's part of the recipe. Next, how do we measure the effectiveness of our recipes? How do we know that our recipes have gotten better and better and made us wealthier and wealthier? And the measure that we use, and we'll talk about this more in coming weeks, is called per capita GDP, which is the average value of goods and services produced per person. So we try to take the value of all the goods and services produced in the economy, divide it by the number of people, and that gives an indication of our average wealth or average income. And that in turn gives an indication of how effective our recipes are. The higher the value of what we produce, the more sophisticated and well-developed our recipes are. Now, you sometimes hear that poverty is getting worse. That's actually not true. Despite the common phrase, the rich get richer and the poor get poorer, it's more like the rich get richer and the poor get richer. There is progress against poverty, but like the economic growth process itself, it's slow. Remember, if you go back to 1500, this one bag of flour, and today 430 bags of flour, well, that didn't happen overnight. That happened over the course of 500 years. And what we're seeing in the world as a whole is other countries catching up with the most highly developed countries. They're not catching up instantly, but they're catching up gradually. And so there's this table one that says economic performance and speed of learning. I pulled this off of a paper that somebody wrote, and in the you see if you look at the first line in the table, the line that says 18 OECD. That's an average of 18 OECD countries, and you see the number 5150 under the first column there. That means that the average value of the goods and services produced in 18 OECD countries in the year 1950, that's what that label up at the top means, why 1950? Year 1950, they produced $5,150 worth of goods and services. So that's what that number means. The value of their recipes, in some sense, was $500,150 in 1950. By the year 2001, those OECD countries, the average income was 20,110. So they had quadrupled their income from 1950 to 2001. So they went from 5150 to 20,110. Then the next thing in the table is an attempt to place countries in terms of what year they're in economically. So Africa, as of 1950, was in the same position that the major OECD countries were in 1727. So that's how backward Africa was. If we look at Africa and you move over to the third column, you see 1727 is the year that Africa was. And the way they got that is they took the $949 per year per capita income in Africa in 1950 and said, well, when was the OECD income $949 per capita? And they said it was at that level in 1727. So Africa as of 1950 was in 1727. As of 2001, Africa had moved up to 1860. That is, they were at the same level of income as the wealthier countries were in 1860. So still behind, but not as far behind. Then you go down to the Middle East. They were about 100 years behind in 1950, and now they're about 50 years behind. What they call the Asian dragons, and I'm not sure which Asian countries that is. I assume China's in there. They were about 100 years behind in 1950, almost caught up today. Maybe that isn't China. Maybe that's things like South Korea, Japan. That's probably what the Asian dragons are, South Korea and Japan and so on. Then if you look at India, they were extremely impoverished in 1950. They were not even at the level of the major countries were in 1500. And India, as of year 2001, is only at the level of about 1866. China was also extremely backward in 1950, but they've moved up even farther to about the level of 1917. So that's sort of an interesting perspective on different countries and how fast they're learning and developing. But in most cases, the development has been fairly rapid. The one exception is Latin America, which was closer to being caught up in 1950 than it is today. So Latin America's growth has been extremely slow. A country like Argentina, which was almost a well-developed first-world country early in this century, has really slipped back due to poor governance. Mostly just very poor governance. Okay, the next thing I'll talk about is progress against poverty within the United States. And this is I call this the escalation of income. The Washington Post ran a story in which they pointed out that people in the middle income range, 35,000 to 50,000, that population had shrunk between 1967 and 2003. And then they went on to say in the story, well, this shows how the middle class is being squeezed. Well, they had all this data in the article, and I simply put it together in the table. And what you can see is that the middle class was squeezed up. That is, the reason that the 35,000 to 50,000 category shrank is that the 75,000 and up category grew tremendously. It grew from 8.2% of households to 26.1%. And in fact, all of the lower income categories shrank as a percentage of households. And by the way, this is adjusted for inflation, so it has nothing to do with inflation. This is people's the real value of what people had has gone up. And I call this process the escalation of income, and there are really a couple of components to this escalator. One is just overall economic growth. On average, the well-being of people in this country is higher than it was in 1967. If you look at things like the appliances that are in people's houses today, what poor people have in their houses today is better than what average people had in the 1960s. And then, in addition to this overall economic growth, you have what I call individual family improvements. That is, if you look at the income distribution at any point in time, and you look at the bottom of the income distribution, the people who have the lowest incomes, they tend to be new immigrant families and young families. So you'll see people in their 20s who've just finished their schooling, or people who just came here from other countries, and they start out at the very bottom. But then if you look over time, if you were to look at them 30 years from now, a lot of those families have moved up into the middle and higher brackets. So when we talk about so if the bottom of the even if the bottom of the escalator didn't move very much, so if you said, gee, the bottom 10% of families had low incomes in 1980 and they haven't gotten much higher now, that doesn't mean that individual families' incomes didn't rise. It just means that there's a new set of people at the bottom of the escalator. So the people in the 1980s who had low incomes, they've now established their households, they've been in this country longer, and their incomes generally have gone up. And the people who are at the bottom of the escalator today tend to be, again, brand new immigrants. It's a new set of people. So that, because of these escalator effects, because people, after they've established their families a while and after they've been in this country a while, their incomes go up. Plus the fact that that whole escalator tends to move up because of overall economic growth, those two processes are reducing and have reduced poverty in the United States. So finally, I'd like to conclude with a reminder of these three ethics of growth, because if your goal is to reduce poverty, then you have to root for the extension and the expansion of these three ethics. The ethics being the work ethic, the public service ethic, and the learning ethic, particularly in other countries. There are parts of the world where work is not valued, where people who work hard are looked down on, and in fact, there are parts of the United States where that's true as well. The public service ethic, there are many, many countries, unfortunately, where people who work for the government are little more than thieves. That it's just there's not much difference between government and organized crime in some countries. And so this public service ethic, which we take for granted, is not established. And it's not necessarily because people are public-spirited in the United States and they're not public-spirited elsewhere. It probably has more to do with a long history and a system of checks and balances in government that we have that other countries have not had historically. And then finally, the learning ethic. Again, very important. There are lots of impediments to learning. There are a lot of superstitious beliefs. There's a lot of hatred of new ideas around the world. There's a lot of resistance to change. And all those things can impede learning. And the learning ethic is very important to growth. So those are the what I consider the three important ingredients to eliminating poverty and to increasing wealth. But those are, it's not a simple engineering problem, and it's not as simple as putting a man on the moon.